The next topic of our journal club was a Patterns of Care study that our CME group published in April 2005, in which we presented dozens of case situations to randomly selected community-based oncologists and 31 breast cancer clinical investigators, and in fact, both Dr. Vogel and Dr. Burstein participated in this study. Specifically for this journal club, we focused on patterns of care of adjuvant endocrine therapy, where we have continued to track major shifts in practice starting in 2002 after the first presentation of the ATAC trial, demonstrating an advantage for anastrozole over tamoxifen in postmenopausal women, both in terms of relapse rate and safety, and subsequent trials of exemestane and also anastrozole after 2 to 3 years of tamoxifen and letrozole after 5 years. Our data reveal a dramatic shift in prescribing of adjuvant aromatase inhibitors in postmenopausal women, with anastrozole now being the most common upfront endocrine therapy in breast cancer, and with most postmenopausal women who had previously been started on adjuvant tamoxifen being switched to either exemestane or anastrozole after 2 to 3 years, and many patients being started on letrozole after 5 years of tamoxifen. Endocrine therapy for premenopausal women is much more heterogeneous, and although generally most such patients are still started on tamoxifen, a substantial number of case situations prompted oncologists and clinical investigators to consider ovarian suppression and ablation, occasionally alone, but more commonly combined with either tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor, although most clinical investigators prefer entering patients on clinical trials evaluating these strategies. Another area of great heterogeneity relates to the premenopausal patient who's been receiving adjuvant tamoxifen and has ceased menstruation, and Dr. Dresner began our discussion of this challenging situation by presenting a case from his practice.
This is a 44-year-old woman who, just to preface the case, lives on a boat with her husband, and they travel frequently and disappear for periods of 3 to 6 months to various spots. She presented with a small lump in her right breast. It was a 1.2 centimeter right ductal carcinoma, 0 of 12 nodes positive. It was strongly estrogen receptor positive, HER2 positive, and FISH positive.
How about the PR?
PR was positive as well. After undergoing her lumpectomy, she received 4 cycles of AC in a dose-dense fashion. Almost immediately after finishing the AC, she started to resume menstruation. It had very transiently stopped for just 1 cycle. At that point, I felt we needed to discuss hormone options, because I was unhappy about the continued menstruation, and we discussed the fact that she lived on a boat and disappeared for long periods of time and what would be best. I discussed with her different options, including oophorectomy. I didn't feel tamoxifen was a reasonable option based on the retrospective data of possible HER2 resistance. And we discussed Arimidex in those patients that were postmenopausal. At that point, she chose to undergo laparoscopic oophorectomy bilaterally, and she was started on Arimidex. We discussed the issues of osteoporosis, especially because of her age. We did a baseline DEXA scan, which was negative, and we decided to proceed with yearly Zometa. She had no interest in taking an oral medication. She had a prescription plan and didn't think she could get it renewed around the world or wherever they were traveling, so she wanted something that involved the least amount of oral therapy where she had to get prescriptions renewed.
Now, how far out is she at this point?
She's now a year out.
A year out, okay. And you said it was a 1.2 centimeter tumor?
That's correct.
Okay, and you mentioned that you gave her dose-dense AC without a taxane, is that correct?
That's correct.
Hal, can you comment on that? I know there's an intergroup study that's included that as, you know, a focus. What are your thoughts about that in a non-protocol setting?
Well, you've given her a lot of flexibility, but I'm not sure you've given her treatments for which you can point to a lot of compelling data that they're exactly the thing that one can do. And that's where clinical medicine meets the published literature. AC times 4 is usually given every 3 weeks. there is an ongoing intergroup node negative study that had been comparing AC every 3 weeks for four cycles versus that for six cycles. And when the DOSTENS data from CALGB9741 came along, they did switch the schema so that patients are now getting the AC every 2 weeks. So that is being widely used as part of this node negative trial. Whether it's better or different than AC every 3 weeks when you just look at the AC patients is not known. Similarly, there are really no data for initiation of AI therapy in women who are premenopausal at the time of their diagnosis who have oophorectomy. Biochemically, they ought to work the same way. But it must be acknowledged that the AI trials typically involved women who had had natural menopause and certainly not women who were premenopausal following chemotherapy who would then be randomized to either tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor. And I think most people aren't too hung up on that, but there is a certain school that says maybe the biology of these tumors might be a little bit different. The third thing is the initiation of yearly Zometa, which I believe has been studied on an every six-month schedule and a quarterly schedule, but to my knowledge, and perhaps I don't keep up with the osteoporosis literature intimately, but I'm not aware of a yearly schedule. There may be data for the osteoporosis literature. What's been studied in women on AI therapy has been every six-month treatment, I believe, was presented at ASCO, and that seems to be helpful for preventing bone loss. So whether you need to start it now before she goes off to the Seychelles or wherever she's sailing to this year, or whether you can wait and see her back in a year or two and follow her bone density is not clear. Presumably she's getting plenty of vitamin D from all her sun exposure. Hopefully she's also getting some calcium and things like that as well. So those are some of the more technical pieces, but I think, you know, you've clearly made it a very convenient and practical schedule for a patient, and certainly the hope would be that she would do well.
Before we go on, I wanted to sort of go through a couple things that we found in the patterns of care. A couple points about what we found in our patterns of care study. First is very frequent use of online models to estimate risk. And I'm curious, Dr. Dresner, do you use any of the available models, adjuvant, et cetera?
Yes, adjuvant online.
Did you use it in this patient, do you know?
Yes.
Since everybody who's over 60 in South Florida seems to be playing golf and sailing regularly, I mean, I think that, you know, there would be some temptation to think about chemotherapy. But, you know, there's no question that the most important treatment for her is anti-estrogen therapy. And this is where I think the models can be very helpful, like Peter Ravdin's model, to sort of frame how much benefit is there for chemotherapy. And the answer would be, you know, there would probably be a 2 to 4% improvement in her 5 to 10-year disease-free survival. And if she looked at that and said, hey, where do I sign up? I would offer her chemo. And if she looked at and said, you got to be kidding me, I got a golf tee time tomorrow at 10 o'clock and I'm not going to mess with it, I would say that's a good decision and go ahead and get radiation therapy.
Let me get back to the hormonal therapy in this case and again point out that the strategy that was utilized here is not uncommon in terms of utilizing ovarian suppression or ablation plus an AI in a very high-risk patient, much more common or more common in clinical investigators. You also see a fair amount of tamoxifen and LHRH agonists used. And again, this is even higher in patients with HER2-positive tumors. Hal, what are your thoughts about what's happening in practice in terms of, obviously we have the soft trial, the text trial, looking at these issues, but for patients who aren't eligible for studies, what do you think is sort of standard of care and what do you think about these numbers?
Well, the standard of care for premenopausal women is tamoxifen. The value of adding ovarian suppression to tamoxifen and chemotherapy is something we are all very interested in knowing, but it's been hard to figure out so far. The latest overview does not suggest that there's a substantial benefit to adding ovarian suppression to chemotherapy, but most of the women who get chemotherapy go into menopause, so it's kind of a moot discussion for those women. I think the challenge arises in a case like this where the woman doesn't go into menopause, or you have a very young woman, you know, less than 35, women who historically do not go into menopause. Certainly for higher risk women in that category, I've been tempted to offer ovarian suppression, women with multiple positive nodes, women with very large tumors, because of a sense that these young women don't do as well, and at least part of the reason they don't do as well is because they don't go into menopause with chemotherapy. And one of the things that CMF did very well is put women into menopause, and some of the newer regimens actually don't do it quite as efficiently. So in those women, I'm often tempted to add an LHRH agonist to offer ovarian suppression. And I still continue to give tamoxifen to most of those women because there are data for using that combination in the adjuvant setting. And there's very little data, to my knowledge, and actually no efficacy data as yet for AIs in combination with LHRH agonist therapy. There are data on bone health in those women, but not not clinical cancer outcomes as yet. So the downside is that there are clearly more side effects to adding ovarian suppression. And for young women in particular, it's much more intense menopausal symptoms, hot flashes and night sweats, much more complained about vaginal dryness and sexual dysfunction. And these can be real problems for otherwise healthy young women.
Chuck, we know, as you can see here, there's quite a number of oncologists who do use this strategy of ovarian suppression plus an AI, again, much more commonly in the multiply node positive, HER2 positive situation. Is that a strategy that you utilize in a non-protocol setting?
Yes. I think that in the HER2 positive patient, although we do not have level one evidence, the weight of evidence would seem to be indicating that the aromatase inhibitors are probably better drugs in this particular setting. From the neoadjuvant trial of Elis, albeit a small trial, and even in the Lipton trial, when the final results of the Lipton trial came in, while all of the hormonal therapies did less well in HER2-positive patients, the aromatase inhibitors appeared to do better. So if I have a HER2 patient, even though we do not have hard and fast data, I would use an aromatase inhibitor and an LHRH, or as in this case, a BSO.
I just clarify my remarks. I have been impressed by those data as well for postmenopausal women. I use the HER2 status often to choose between tamoxifen and an aromatase inhibitor. As far as treating premenopausal women, I think it's a murkier issue. We just don't really have a lot of data for such women. And I have as yet not taken a patient to surgical oophorectomy just so that I could put them on an AI.
What about the lobular histology in this case, Chuck?
Well, there was a recent publication from the MD Anderson group, albeit in locally advanced breast cancer, that the chemotherapeutic sensitivity of the lobulars in that paper was reduced. And I really can't say. I mean, I've always sort of felt that they've been relatively equivalent in terms of between ductal and lobulars in terms of response to chemotherapy. But that paper would seem to indicate that perhaps the lobulars are a bit less sensitive, at least in the locally advanced setting.